What's up, guys, and welcome to the Meeple Minded Podcast, the podcast where we talk all things tabletop gaming. My name is Jason, aka Spared No Expense John Hammond.
And my name's Ian Life Finds a Way Malcolm, and along with Paul, join us as we bumble our way through the gaming industry. So pop the kettle on, grab a brew, and let's get on with today's episode.
Yes, today's episode. If you hadn't guessed, believe it or not, we're going to be talking about dinosaurs again, aren't we?
It's almost like we like dinosaurs.
I know. It's been probably about 9 months since we did the Dinogenics review, though. It's been a hell of a long time.
The irony is we played that yesterday, too.
We did indeed, right before we decided to do this episode, or it reminded us to do this episode, more to the point. So, before we get to that, though, how are you doing this week, Ian?
I'm not too bad. How are you, Jason?
I am fan-dabby-dosy. Work is keeping me incredibly busy. My room is almost done, which means I can start moving my stuff back in soon, which means I can start sleeping properly. And yeah, that's always good. Oh, trust me, I really do. I'm a horrible person when I'm tired, and you should know this.
You don't need to be tired to be that.
This is very true indeed. So what have you been up to this past week?
Work, and a bit more work.
Nice.
Nothing exciting at all. Yourself?
Yeah, pretty much the same, mate. Just work and like I say, coming home and wishing that I had my old bedroom back. But hey-ho, there you go.
Let me just go grab a violin.
But, I mean, the positive things are of it all. A couple of days ago, the UK started to ease its lockdown restrictions, which I am so, so happy about. It's been a long time coming. And we're now in the process of being able to see some of our friends and family. Are you looking forward to meeting up outside?
I was about to say, you need to put that clarification in there because we are allowed to meet, but it is still outside. But yes, I've got plans already. Me and the missus, I've organised some meetups with friends. One to game, which is good. Way out in my back garden on Friday, and then go for a walk with a few others on Saturday. So
very nice. You best just hope that the weather holds out for that game then.
It's supposed to. It won't be as blisteringly hot as it has been today, but
yeah, it's been quite a nice day today, to be fair. And there's us wasting the evening sitting here talking to a computer screen.
Nerd.
Hey ho, we like doing it, don't we?
We do. Really? Yeah. This is a normal evening for us.
So yeah, I think we'll just jump straight in to the main topic or discussion today. We are talking about Dinosaur Island this week. Now, you have heard us talk before about its main rival, should we say, in Dinogenics, which we absolutely love. But we also have some opinions about this game, don't we, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of history between these two games as well. Both of them kickstarted in 2017, I believe.
It was, yes.
However, unbeknown to each other, they both basically come up with a very similar game idea at the same time. And Dinosaur Island managed to get its Kickstarter out first, which actually in turn ended up delaying Dinogenics.
Yeah, I think they took the wise decision to delay it by a month, because otherwise you're gonna have two of basically the same game with different art styles hitting Kickstarter exactly the same time. People weren't gonna buy both if it was in the same month. So
the irony is I didn't spot Dinosaur Island but did spot Dinogenics. And I actually went back when Dinosaur Island did its second campaign and picked it up after good reviews, just before Dinogenics actually arrived. So it was quite an interesting one for me to actually have both games at very similar time frames.
Very nice. So what is Dinosaur Island? Well, Dinosaur Island is a medium complexity worker placement, card and dice drafting game for ages 8 and up, with a playtime of about 90 to 120 minutes. The game's first release, as Ian said, back in 2017 when it was kickstarted by Pandasaurus Games, and has since seen the release of a dedicated two-player game and a second Kickstarter, as Ian alluded to as well. But for the purpose of this discussion, we will be focusing on the base game only. So it's now my favourite time of the podcast, where I get to shut up for a few minutes and hand over to the resident rules junkie to explain how to play Dinosaur Island.
So the game is played over five phases: research phase, market phase, worker phase, the park phase, and the cleanup phase. most of these phases have their own boards, whether it be your own player boards or an overall global board. So the first phase is the research phase. At this point, this is how you get your DNA for the dinosaurs you require and how you actually get the dinosaur recipes. Player one rolls all of the DNA dice and they are put along the top available DNA track across the top. And you have three scientists to play this turn, a level one, a level two, and a level three. They are multipliers for some bits or they are required for others. I'll explain in 2 seconds. So the first thing you have an option to do is to research DNA. So you put your scientist underneath one of the dice and you will gain the DNA on that dice times the level of the scientist. So for example, if you have a dice with two blue DNA on it, you gain and you put your level two scientist to it, you would gain four blue DNA that turn. But this leads me on to the next bit. You have a cold storage, which is how many of each DNA you can currently store. There are black markers at the game starts, like on the basic DNA, they start at 5, and on the advanced DNA, they start at 2, which means you can't have that amount or more at that point. So for example, if you had that 2 blue DNA dice and you put your level 3 worker against it, you would gain 6, but you'd only be able to store 4 of them. So you would lose the extra 2. But another thing you can choose to do is put your scientist in the cold storage to increase the limits by the level of the researcher. So if you put your level 3 researcher in that area, for example, you can up your cold storage by 3 points. Doesn't have to be in the same color. It can be over all 6 colors that are available, and you can choose how you balance it. You might choose to up one color by 2 and a different color by 1, or one color just by 3, for example. The last thing you can do is you can buy a dinosaur recipe. This game is split into herbivores, small carnivores, and large carnivores. Each paddock allows one dinosaur to start with, but herbivores are level 1, the small carnivores are level 2, and the large carnivores are level 3. For example, you can only gain a Gigantosaurus as a large carnivore by using a level 3 scientist. The bigger the dinosaur, the more points they genuinely score and more attraction level your park gains, but also the more threat that they generate for later in the game, which that means they might break out and eat all your people. This leads you on to phase 2 of the game, the market phase. Another individual board. This is where you spend all of your hard-earned monies to go and buy attractions for your parks, lab upgrades for your parks, and to purchase DNA as well. So this is where you build up your basically your engine for being able to do stuff during the game. There are also specialists in this section as well. You can have up to 3 specialists at a time. They will also boost your capability of doing things. So this then leads us on to the worker phase. So in this phase, all players will get to assign each of their workers from their worker pool in order to take the lab actions. Any scientist you didn't use during your research phase can now be used as a worker as well. So basically, all the sections you have on your board allow you to do different things with these workers, and there is a limit to how many times you can do it. For example, a basic board will come with a refined DNA, which is turned 2 basic DNAs of particular colors into an advanced DNA. You can create dinosaurs. There's a tool bench based on your basic thing. You can do this as many times as you like in a turn, with as long as you have the workers, to upgrade your security level by 1. And then there's gain money, which is a 3 coin, a 2 coin, and a 1 coin. And you have 2 blank spaces to upgrade your working station. You can replace other lab upgrades over the top of each other. So you've always got the option to upgrade your lab as the game goes on. This is how you can assign the dinosaurs to your park. You upgraded the paddocks during the build attraction phase. So attractions are either the paddock upgrades or they are extra buildings along the park. And that's how you generate the excitement for your park and threat and everything else. The more dinosaurs you have, the more money you earn, the more visitors that can come see them. So that then leaves you to phase 4 of the game, which is the park phase. In this phase, visitors will show up at the park, giving you money for admission fees, and they will also line up to see the different dinosaurs and exhibits that you have, earning victory points as long as they survive without getting eaten. So in turn order, each player draws a number of visitors from the bag equal to their excitement level. You might draw patrons, which are gold, who are paying customers that will come happily into your park, but you also might draw hooligans, which is bad news. Hooligans sneak in without paying, so you don't generate the money. Once you've drawn an allotted visitors, place them all at your park entrance and then collect $1 from each of the bank per patron. So unfortunately, hooligans get in first, which is really irritating, but it's part of the game. And you assign the visitors that are waiting to come into your park to the available spaces. So, for example, the junior roller coaster that it shows has a space for two park goers, so you can assign two there. And for a dinosaur pen that's got one dinosaur in it, you can add one meeple, and then they gain extras for each upgrade you have. So if you have a level 3 paddock for, say, your carnivore, you can have assign three of your people there. Anyone that can't be assigned don't get in. After all of that, and you've signed everyone, you see if your dinosaurs get out. So you check your threat level, and this is done by a base threat level each turn by the dice that aren't used, and also by the threat markers on each of your dinosaurs. As I said earlier, they have a threat rating on each one. So if your security level is not higher than your threat level, then you have problems. So if they're not higher, the dinosaurs get loot and will eat visitors in your park. The number of visitors that are eaten is the difference between your security level and your threat level. You choose which visitors inside your park are eaten, but all patrons get eaten before the hooligans. They are sneaky after all. And you -1 victory point for every visitor eaten. And then at the end of the round, you've got the cleanup phase that includes the scoring victory points. In turn order, you score 1 victory point for each surviving patron, an attraction or dinosaur exhibit. Do not score for hooligans inside your park, and do not score for any visitors stuck in line at the entrance. And then at the end, you reset the turn order, seeing who's got the most excitement level, refresh the market, reveal new dino recipes, return all your workers and your scientists, remove all the visitors from the board, and resolve any plot twists that are in the game. And then the game will end when there's only one objective card left unclaimed. Each player adds their score and then see who's got the most points. I didn't mention there are objectives in the game. I should have mentioned this earlier. As they're completed, you put markers on them. Anyone else can attempt to complete those on that turn that one is completed. If they're not, then that's it gets flipped over and that's it. For example, one of the objectives I'm looking at is have 12 dinosaurs in your park, and this is one of the objectives for a long game. They have different settings for different speeds of the game, which is good. If I was to complete it and Jason didn't, once that turn's finished, no one else gets it, you put your own player markers on those. And at the end, I would score the 8 victory points for having completed that mission. And that is roughly how to play the game. It's not my best ever explanation. This is quite a long game, and it's quite a confusing game to actually explain. But once you get the hang of it, it's quite, you know, it does move quite smoothly. But this game is big, just so you're aware. The player boards are huge. Each player has their own Phase 3 and Phase 4 board in front of them, as well as a universal Phase 1 and Phase 2 section. So it is that was a very long-winded explanation for a very complex game to learn, but simple game to play.
I think a round of applause for Ian is definitely in order there. So yeah, we'll give you one of those. How about that?
And for the bit that you guys at home won't know, you don't want to know how many recording attempts that took.
That is a bit of a mission and a half to talk about how to play that game, isn't it? Although it's, in all honesty, it's not as complex as it sounds when you're actually playing it in person. But yeah, that's long-winded, isn't it?
Yep.
So now my bit, and as you can probably guess by how many different things there are to do in the game, there are just as many components to talk about. So now it's Ian's turn to sit there for a couple of minutes while I try and power through this list of things that comes in the box. So before I start this, I will say this is, as far as I'm aware, this is all the stuff that comes in the retail version of this game. There are obviously some Kickstarter exclusives that we have. There are some Geolux bits in there that we also have. But yeah, we're going to try and do all of this stuff. This should all be in the retail box. So here we go. In the box, we have 16 specialist cards, 80 visitor meeples, 36 workers, 15 objective cards, 74 money tokens, 10 DNA dice, plot twist cards, 1 research center board, 1 track board, 1 marketplace board, 4 park boards, 4 lab boards, 20 lab tiles, 20 paddock tiles, 27 attraction tiles, 14 dino recipe tiles, 27 attraction tiles, 50 dinosaurs, 12 scientists, and 100 cube markers.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
Indeed. So, wow. Components galore in this game. And if I remember correctly, the retail cost for this is in the 50 to 60 mark. So there's a lot there for not that much money. So, yeah, let's talk about those components. Let's talk about the artwork on that they've used for this game. I have been known to refer to this as a psychedelic acid trip in the past. And I stand by that. The game is super colourful. Seriously, think of psychedelic acid trip Dino Park building and you've got Dinosaur Island. So, yeah, how do you feel about the component qualities in this game, Ian?
I believe the term that the game itself used was retro.
Yes.
No, I do like it. I do like the bright colours and I do like the attention to detail on even some of the naming for some of the attractions and things. There are a lot of negatives to this game, which I'll come on to in a bit. The meeples, they're plastic. The people meeples are amazing. The dinosaur meeples, not so much, especially considering discovering that the base game, the retail version of the game, only comes with Triceratops meeples.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a bit shocking, to be completely honest. The Kickstarter one that Ian has actually has the various different types of dinosaurs in meeple form. They're all the same colour.
Bright pink.
Yeah, they're bright pink. But yeah, the retail version, to our understanding, actually only comes with the shape of a Triceratops, which is a bit, yeah, meh. Not too sure about that. But hey-ho, we'll move on. I personally, absolutely, my favourite part of this entire game, if I'm completely honest, are actually the dice. I love them because they look like the amber that you find on the dig sites in the Jurassic Park movies. And I think that is by design. I think that's what they're meant to look like. But they glisten. They've got that really nice sort of amber orangey glow to them. And they're nice and chunky as well. And you feel good when you roll them.
You do. I have one reservation on these dice. And you'll hear me chime on this time and time again. They're too rigid and square. So they don't roll. That's my only reservation. If they had made them exactly as they are with a little bit more curvature on the edges and the corners, they would roll really nicely. But
fair enough.
That's my reservation on any game that uses these sort of dice. So it doesn't matter how pretty they look. I will always have that trigger. And that includes official D&D dice. You know, their D6s in a D&D set drive me barmy. Because you'd think a game like that would, you know, where all the other dice roll really nicely, would want ones that don't just clunk and slide.
Yeah, I do understand that. I'm not personally as triggered as you are for it, but I do get where you're coming from. But let's just tackle straight away the elephant in the room, the art choice, the art style of this game. I'm going to let you go first, because if I say what I think now, it could be completely different in 5 minutes' time. So I'm gonna let you make your decision as to how you like it before I announce my feelings.
I'm going to say I actually quite enjoy it. I quite like the retro-y bright style. It makes the game visually appealing. The dinosaurs don't look too bad. He says, looking at a picture of the bright red Allosaurus, which I'm not quite so sure on. My reservations more come with some of the gameplay mechanics into this game, which we'll come back to in a minute. But I don't mind. The meeples look good for what they are. It would have been nice if they were all different colours, but again, shouldn't be doing this, but comparing it to Dinogenics that have those readily available, you know, it makes it easier to spot what you're looking for. But again, that's also looking at a retail pledge on a Kickstarter, a pledge on a Kickstarter rather than the retail version. Again, so the other big issue with that is not liking the fact that you don't get all the different dinosaurs. But the art style overall, I do like the cards. It's sometimes quite a lot to take in because it's so epically bright, but at least it makes it easier to differentiate between a lot of things within the game.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, you've probably guessed. Overall, the art style is not hugely to my taste, but I can, I really do see what they were going for with having such an out there art style, because it makes it stand out on the table. It is very very vibrant, very bright. And when we have been playing it in places like our local gaming store, it does bring people to the table. So, all right, I'll go for that. I'll go for it. Like I said, it's not really for me, but it doesn't stop me from playing the game because the game itself is very, very good. I do like the fact that the game is riddled, and I mean riddled with little nods to the original movie franchise that it is totally based on, but totally not based on because, you know, IP. And that's one of the things, right? The art style of the original movies, we all know, is quite dark. This is the polar opposite. However, there are certain aspects of the original film, just to pick one out off, you know, off the top of my head, is the original cars from the tour. They're iconic. Everyone knows them. They're brightly coloured. And if you literally took that car and put it onto the art style of Dinosaur Island, it would blend in. That's the weirdest thing. So yeah, I kind of get it. I do kind of get it. I do like that vibrant art style, but it does give me a headache if I play it for too long. So yeah, maybe it's just me. I don't know. But yeah, that's the art style. I think it's captured the theme incredibly well. You know, you're playing a dinosaur park builder with the game. So
I mean, to just say how good they've captured the theme, one of the attractions in this game is a food outlet called Clever Grill. I mean,
if you don't get that,
go then, watch Jurassic, you know, Park.
Go watch Jurassic Park, yeah. So that's the art style. That's the theme. What about the quality? How do you find the quality of those pieces?
Plastic meeples versus wooden meeples. Wooden wins every time, unfortunately. The plastic feels quite cheap, but for such a huge game, I suppose something had to give. But speaking of which, the box of this game is not great because you just physically cannot fit everything in. And then when you add the expansions as well, it's just my box is actually split down the side because the games just don't fit. There's so many boards, there's so many pieces. I mean, again, we'll probably come onto that in a second with design of the actual game itself. But just the sheer amount of components you have for this game is probably good value for money, but it's just there's too much.
Yeah, I have to agree. Echo exactly what Ian said there, that the build quality starts with the box. The box feels pretty rigid, but once you've actually punched everything out, it just doesn't fit. We have not come up with a way. And we have literally sat there for an entire game evening playing Tetris with this damn game, trying to fit it back in the box. And it doesn't happen. It doesn't fit properly. And it's not like it's a small box. You know, it's quite a big box, but it's just so much crammed into one box. It just doesn't work. And once you have got everything in there, it's about the same weight as a paving slab. So this thing is dangerous. You know, you don't want to annoy the person that actually owns the game, because he'll probably clock you around the head with it. So
I'm going to let Jason start on the next one, seeing as I've harped on about it enough. Game mechanics, what's your thoughts?
This is where things get very difficult for me, because I have to, at this point, compare it to Dinogenics. Now, I will give Dinosaur Island its credit. Dinosaur Island is available for people to buy right now. Dinogenics is not. Dinogenics was a Kickstarter exclusive. However, I much prefer the mechanics that game uses. I'm not a huge fan of the DNA mechanics side of things of Dinosaur Island. While it's quite cool to have the random element to it, which more replicates the whole digging for the DNA fossils and stuff like that, it's a bit too much luck element side of it, especially if you are trying to go after a certain sort of dinosaur. I'm just not a huge fan of that side of it. I much prefer Dinogenics' way of doing it with the cards and essentially buying DNA like a company would do. The phases I like, because everything is numbered nicely on the boards. You know which board you're doing, which phase. It's all very clear on the board. So that side of it I think is fine. I really do like that. But yeah, overall, I find it very hard. I do. I love this game, but there's just a better version out there. Couple that with the fact that I'm not a huge fan of the chosen art stylings. Yeah, unfortunately, it does lose. It does lose to Dinogenics for me.
So I really like the mechanics of this game again as well. But my biggest issue with the base game of this, which they tried to slightly fix with the expansion, that is the dinosaur mechanics themselves. So you have a choice between herbivores, small carnivores, and large carnivores. Short of this fact that each one has a different DNA type to pick, you know, so like my Triceratops might need one blue, two green DNA, and a purple advanced or something like that. I'm just plucking it out of the air. That's not an actual guarantee. The next herbivore will just be a different orientation of the same DNA strand, you know, different types of DNA strand. It'll be the same rarities, and it will be the same points. It's the same threat, all that sort of stuff. There's no differential between the dinosaurs. where T-Rex is the same as a Spinosaurus, which is the same as a Gigantosaurus. Just doesn't matter which one you get other than which one you've managed to gain more DNA for as the game's gone on. You know, one might need two red over two blue, for example, so it might be beneficial for you to have gone for that dinosaur. But at the end of the day, Dinogenics is dinosaurs. Each one does a different thing, and each one gives you something different and a different strategy to the game. Base game of this game is just A, B, or C, basically, and how many of each do you want? That I find incredibly frustrating. For the DNA mechanic being on dice instead of cards, I don't actually mind, but it just feels like there's no point to there being it that in there and any difference, because all the dinosaurs need the same thing.
To be honest, I'd actually completely forgotten about that, because that is something that sort of grinds me a little bit as well. But the real question is, and I know that this is 100% true for me, do you feel that way because you've been spoiled by Dinogenics and the fact that we have the option of both, that both hit the market at the same time?
I don't think so, because it's always bugged me that you get the T-Rex, I get the Gigantosaurus. They do the same thing. There's no differential. Every time you play this game, you've got the same problem. Mm. You know, unless you add the expansion that adds the water dinosaurs, which were all different, but then you're stuck playing with water dinosaurs, because they don't fix the problem with the base game.
Mm.
They just mask it with a pretty plaster with the with the new dinosaurs that are available.
Yeah.
If each dinosaur had given a different threat level or a different excitement level, you know, or something to risk reward, and actually whether you want to buy that dinosaur or not.
Yeah, that's very fair. Yeah, other than that, have you got any other final thoughts that you would have on the game itself?
I still really like this game, and I would still play it. I still bring this to the table. You know, I would equally have this on my shelf as much as Dinogenics. However, when a choice is put in front of me to which one I'd rather play, unfortunately this one doesn't win out, which is a shame. I'm yet to try the two-player variant of this that I own, because I was lucky enough to do an all-in pledge for all three games at once. So their second campaign was Dinosaur Island, Dualosaur Island, which is the two-player version, and Totally Liquid, which is the expansion that added the aquatic dinosaurs and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So having that available increases the game a little bit, and I'm interested to see how a two-player only dueling version of this game works.
Yeah.
But overall, Dinogenics did a better job with the base game and then did an even better job with their expansion.
Yeah, I completely agree. I would be very interested in seeing what came of the Dinosaur World Kickstarter that they did last year, because obviously that was a standalone game from my understanding, and it seemed like it introduced quite a few new things. Unfortunately, I know neither myself nor you actually backed that game.
Well, this shows what we think of this game in comparison. This game didn't hook us enough to make us spend more money with this company on another game.
Yeah, which is a real shame. So, yeah, I've got some final thoughts. Would I recommend this game? Well, if you like dinosaurs, experiencing the joy of watching your friends, family, and other park guests get eaten by bloodthirsty monsters of the prehistoric age, then, yeah, this is a great game for you. It's readily available. As I said, this is in retail. It's fairly reasonably priced, as we said, with what you get. The quality is pretty good. Like, the boards themselves are very good. They're very good quality. I couldn't rate them any higher. Not a huge fan of the meeples. I like how they look, being really small, but as you said, wooden meeples wins over plastic meeples any day. I do have a little bit of an issue with the age rating of 8+. It's not because there's anything in the game that an 8-year-old shouldn't be looking at. There's no blood, there's no gore or anything like that. I just think it's just that little bit too complex for someone of such a young age. I would wonder whether an 8-year-old would struggle to understand how to play the game.
There is a lot going on in this game, shown by how many times it took me to actually do the how to play of this. We haven't played this game, unfortunately, for a year, thanks COVID, you know, because this is a game that's easier in person, I think, anyway.
Yeah.
But it's huge as well. You need a massive table to play this. And as I said, there's, with all the phases having their own thing, there's a lot to take in. So I agree with you on that. It might be too much for some, even for some adults to take in all at once.
Mm.
You know, it was difficult trying to simplify that how to play without confusing myself. I mean, it took several recordings where I stop, start, because I thought I knew everything, and then sort of looking at it, confusing myself and having to stop the recording. So
yeah,
that shows that and the rule book's not exactly unclear. I wouldn't say, I don't want to slate that one off. You know, we've done that in the past with some board games, looking at you, Walking Dead, you know, where the rule books define how good or bad a game is because learning it was so terrible. This game's not really that experience, and once you do understand it, it flows fairly well. But there's just so much to remind yourself.
I mean, yeah, just to finish my summary, I think the game theme is really good. It does come across well. For adult players, I think this falls nicely in the sort of lightweight, more towards the medium weight range. There is quite a bit of complexity when it comes to learning. However, once you have done the first round, it's generally pretty easy. And I reckon it's a game that could be enjoyed by all types of gamers, whether it be a strategy gamer, someone who is dedicated to liking co-op games. You know, although this isn't co-op, I can well believe that everyone will enjoy playing this game. Would I recommend someone go out and buy it? Yes, 100%. The fact that you can't buy Dinogenics in stores, in retail, means if you only own this and you never get to play Dinogenics, you're not missing out too much. I think you're missing out a little bit, but you're not missing out to the point that you should feel really down about, you know, not playing Dinogenics. So out of the two, yeah, I'm the same. I would probably play Dinogenics if I had to choose. However, if someone said they wanted to play this, I'd have no problem in setting this up and having a great time playing the game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it falls in that horrible category where we have to say we love the game, but unfortunately there's something just that little bit better that we have and have easy access to. So,
I think to wrap this up, I'm going to give it my rating first today.
Okay.
Solid 8 out of 10.
Ooh.
Maybe a 7. I'm not sure, but it's hard because I can't really fault too much from this game, but we're comparing it and we should, you know, when we shouldn't be, but we can't help but compare it.
Seen as though we're comparing it, and back when we actually did the Dinogenics review, we weren't actually giving it ratings. What would you give Dinogenics?
That's a comparison? 9, maybe even a 10 for me. It's one of my favorite games. So, you know, it's unfortunately, yeah. That's right up there. Okay. I was going to say 9.5 for Dinogenics and 7.5 to 8 for Dinosaur Island.
Okay. So I'm going to come in and say, again, Dinogenics is a 9 for me. There are a couple of bits with it that could be better, but as a whole, it's pretty damn good. This one for me is actually really far down. It's going to be 6.5 for me. The reason it is so much lower than Ian is just the art style chosen did not do it for me. It lost probably a whole point just on that. And that's just me personally. I do not want to slate the game and say it's a terrible game. I just didn't like the choice of art. I much prefer, you know, the dark, dingy, you know,
the realism.
The realism or the realistic aspects of Jurassic Park. When I'm building a dinosaur park and they escape, I want to literally imagine blood and guts all over my park, not, you know, happy Mr. Blobby colors.
Although, so, I'm still going to say it warrants that extra point just for the clever grill joke.
Yes, I do. They definitely nod quite nicely to the original material. So, yeah. Wow. That was a real roller coaster doing that one. How do you feel about that? Because I wasn't expecting us to be quite so negative positive the whole time.
Unfortunately, though, this game sort of warrants it. You know, there's some really good aspects and it is a good game. And it's definitely one that will see the table again and won't be one of the first things to come up if we had to start culling our collections. But unfortunately, there are better variants out there, so we're always going to compare it to those. And there's no two ways around it. So it's the highs and lows of that, I'm afraid.
On a positive note for this game, and I'm going to drop myself a little note here to say I am going to have to put a sensor in here. It's not as as the Jurassic World game.
Yeah, there is far worse Jurassic Park games out there, and this one's got the trademark.
So, yeah, there's a positive note for you to end on there, so I'm really looking forward to seeing the comments section for this one and the emails that we are undoubtedly going to get. What do you guys think about Dinosaur Island? Tell us exactly how wrong we are and why Dinosaur Island is so much better than Dinogenics. I think this would be an argument that both of us might start chomping back on, but but genuinely, we would love to hear your thoughts and opinions on it, guys. Have you played Dinosaur Island? Did you like it? Have you tried both of them? Which one did you prefer? Real hot topic of discussion.
And now over to our own prehistoric exhibit. Over to you, Paul.
Well, you can certainly say that again. So how many Easter eggs have you eaten? What, really? I don't know where you put it all. That's three more than me. Have you ever read the book The Sheep Pig by Dick King Smith? Well, I'm going to start calling you the Duck Pig. What do you mean you've still got room? The eggs have all gone. Yeah, well, there's only the salted caramel hot cross buns we got by accident. I know, what's the big deal with the abundance of salted caramel products lately? Caramel's fine on its own. Don't start throwing condiments at it. Well, that's true, but we were saving those mini eggs to play Wingspan with later. And we'll try not to get them confused again like we did last time. Yeah, I know, they did take a while to appear again, didn't they? But I think 8 times through the dishwasher may be enough. Okay, I'll put them through a couple more times. I think that's a bit too much information for our listeners to cope with, so I'm going to try and distract them with this week's news. Is that alright with you? Yeah, I know you can't move very far, so you just sit tight. Magic fans hoping to get in on the pre-release sets for the latest Strixhaven School of Mages set are in for a small delay. Strixhaven School of Mages will be teleporting players to the college, where some of the card game's most powerful arcane practitioners are supposedly trained. Unfortunately, the lead-up to the set has been studded with controversy, delays, and mistakes at seemingly every turn. On April the 1st, publisher Wizards of the Coast put out a statement that physical cards would not be available in time for pre-release events, both in the United States, where the company is based, and throughout several other countries across the world. Unfortunately, due to shipment delays, the Strixhaven School of Mages pre-release will now be combined with the release date on April the 23rd. Pre-release events and all other Strixhaven School of Mages products will be available beginning that day, the statement read. Additionally, for Thailand, Strixhaven School of Mages bundles will release approximately mid-May. Pre-release events for Magic often occur the week before, giving players an opportunity to try the set in a limited format. Often these coordinated events take place at local game stores, but Wizards of the Coast has been producing take-home bundles through the COVID-19 pandemic. Strixhaven's pre-release was previously planned to begin on April the 16th. The publisher further said that production issues on the draft boosters and Japanese language set boosters for Strixhaven have caused an unexpected shortage and will likely not be available in sufficient quantity, if at all, in many areas during release. Wizards of the Coast claims more boosters will be coming soon at an undisclosed date. The Japanese language boosters, which have a chance to contain one of the alternate art Japanese mystical archive cards, Wizards of the Coast put out another statement April the 1st acknowledging a mistake regarding the artwork on two of the cards. The alternate art for the two cards in question was somehow swapped during development, but the card text remains accurate. Some Reddit users had pointed this out. Both pieces were by the same artist, and the images looked decidedly similar enough to be interchangeable. Players actually expressed liking the switch or simply not noticing before the publisher copped for the error. The alternate Japanese variants are a new project for the trading card game, done to celebrate traditional Japanese artistic style while providing players and collectors a unique subset that will be packaged in several different boosters and boxes. One of those cards caused a small controversy earlier this week when a freelance artist pointed out that one of the mystical archive cards, Crux of Fate, contained not only blatantly plagiarized work from a fan piece she had published in 2016, but also from a previously released card from another artist. Wizards of the Coast announced it would be cutting ties with the established Magic the Gathering illustrator who publicly admitted to the act on March 31st. Artist Jason Felix commented via Twitter, "I've waited to make a public response because I wanted to reach out to the affected artists, Kit LaPena, Raymond Swanland, and Wizards of the Coast first. I was overworked, but that's no excuse. I've messed up and I'm trying to make amends. Here's hoping no other delays come into effect before its release. Fans of Disney Villainous series, and indeed the Marvel spin-off, Marvel Villainous, can rejoice as Ravensburger has just announced his first standalone expansion, Mischief and Malice. Mischief, eh? We all know where this is going. Yep, the first of three playable characters in the set is indeed the trickster god himself, Loki. Alongside him are cutthroat killer Madame Mask and everyone's favourite head in a chair, MODOK. Each will introduce new methods of play and provide a large enough list for a four-player game using only Marvel-aligned characters. Marvel Villainous pits 2-4 players, or 1-3 if you're using the Mischief and Malice set on its own, against each other in a race to enact their own poisonous plot, working along a unique board that tells a story through its procession of objectives. For example, Loki clinches a win by amassing Mischief tokens, which he gains when impersonating other villains in worlds not his own. This introduces a new mechanic via the multiverse cards, which is how he zips across to other people's worlds. Madame Mask must balance the timing and order of her assassinations. Contract kills provide crucial power, but victory only comes by carrying out 8 personal vendettas. And MODOK, true to form, only wants to activate the Cosmic Cube, but must begrudgingly maintain an alliance with AIM, a megacorporation of power-hungry scientists, to achieve his ends. Each villain has their own deck of cards full of powers, resources, and challenges to aid their nefarious ascent. Ravensburger mentioned in a recent press release that the Mischief and Malice character bust movers will be slightly larger and have a metallic look, making them more robust and durable after feedback from players of Marvel Villainous. Previous titles in the Villainous line offered pre-orders, but Ravensburger made no mention of it regarding the latest expansion. But Marvel Villainous, Mischief and Malice will hit retail and local game stores on August the 1st of this year, priced at £18 or $25. Board game royalty Rainer Knizia has just announced his latest title coming to a table later in the year in the form of The Siege of Rundar. Artwork is being provided by Everdell artist Andrew Bosley. The Siege of Rundar sees you trying to defend a fortress against invading forces. The 1-4 player co-op game is set in an ancient castle, marking the entrance to a series of mines rich in gold. For many centuries, the local dwarf population ventured into the mines of Rundar to extract the precious metals within, until it was believed to have been exhausted. However, a recent expedition has seen the discovery of a new vein of gold, which the adventuring group was able to acquire some of before returning to the surface, only to find that they have been intercepted by an entire army. In the deck-building game, players must work together to defend the fortress against the forces of orcs, goblins, and trolls long enough to dig a tunnel to safety. The attacking warriors seek to obtain the newly acquired gold from the player's party. Storming the walls in waves, they must stave off from afar using their ranged weapons, or up close with melee attacks. Should the player successfully keep the attackers at bay long enough to tunnel their way out of Rundar, and indeed win the game. Siege of Rundar will be released in October of this year, with a retail price set to be announced. And we're heading on over to crowdfunding, and the next three are up on Kickstarter, and they all end on Saturday the 1st of May. First up is Seven Moons, Heroes of Dragonreach by Gunpowder Studios. It's for 2-4 players, takes 30 to 60 minutes, and it's for ages 8 years and over. For the base game, it's just £35, or for £47, you get the deluxe game, which includes metal coins and uniquely designed meeples. We all love some meeples. Seven Moons, Heroes of Dragonreach, is an original board game from Gunpowder Studios, set in a mythical, magical world of dragons and monsters, where 2-4 players seek to save the beautiful kingdom of Dragonreach from the impending Shadow Army. In Seven Moons, you play a royal emissary sent out into the kingdom by your monarch to organize the defense of your city from the impending Shadow Army invasion. You will travel the lands, buying and selling resources to fill your war chest, building defenses, recruiting allies, and completing quests. Quests and wilderness encounters can yield rich rewards, but for the most part, you will gain gold to build your defences by buying resources, wood, stone, and iron from the elves, dwarves, and giants at a fixed cost of 1 gold per resource, and selling them at the market of Dragonmarch for a profit. When the Shadow Army figure reaches the seventh moon on the Moonrise track, the game enters the Shadow Phase and the Shadow Army invades Dragonreach. The aim of the game is to have enough strongholds and allies in your city to successfully defend it against the Shadow Army attacks. In a nutshell, it's up to you how you go about readying your city for war. Next up is Planet Fulcrum by Paul Dello. It's for 1 to 4 players, takes 45 to 90 minutes to complete, and it's for 12 years and over. You can pledge for the base game at £25, or £35 includes your own custom character within your game, and £50 features your custom character in the rulebook as a Fulcrum Pioneer. Planet Fulcrum is a strategic 1 to 4 player area control board game with a tech tree character development and deck-driven battles. Players assume the role of an unwitting adventurer, transported, stranded, and endowed with powerful abilities by the mysterious planet to compete for its gifts. To master their newfound skills, players must form a bond with the planetary regions by gathering and distributing fulcra, coalesced cubes of raw power to control territory. Their shared goal will make conflict inevitable as players battle to reduce their rivals' ability and hold over their new home. For every action a player takes, the planet will react, delivering judgment on the player's morality and aligning them to one of three factions. The righteous must work together, whereas the devious bid to subjugate it. Players will accrue points by controlling territory, leveling up power cards and collecting items. Game ends when every territory is under a player's control, and the player with the highest points total becomes the victor. And the next one on Kickstarter is a special one. It's called Steps Board Games by Colleen Sullivan. It's for 2 to 6 players, takes 10 to 15 minutes to complete, and it's for all ages, and again, ends on Saturday the 1st of May. First pledge is £22 or $30 for the game only, but they're welcoming donations to Autism Alliance with your pledge. Steps Board Games was created by Colleen Sullivan, a board-certified behaviour analyst who specialises in working with individuals with autism. Being a board game fan herself, over the last 10 years working in her field, she struggled to find games that were appropriate for her clients' needs, and that's where the idea for Steps Board Games originates from. Steps teaches the learner how to play traditional roll and move style games and addresses other common deficits seen in individuals with autism, including identifying animals, turn taking, social skills, communication, fine motor skills, matching, attending to stimuli, tolerating losing, and cooperative play. Play, of course, is the foundation in teaching language, motor, and social skills. Steps 1 has easy to follow individual game boards featuring unique animal characters with matching tokens that fit in the boards perfectly and stay there, so any accidental bump off the table doesn't ruin the whole evening. A large, colourful token dispenser securely holds the large game tokens in place and releases only one token per turn, as manipulating small pieces on modern board games can become troublesome for those on the spectrum. The game is quick, fast-paced and fun to play, making it easy for the players to stay focused and with extremely easy instructions to follow. Certainly a very unique game for anybody knowing somebody with autism. And on to events now. UKGE released a no new news update last week in regard to this year's event, due to take place from Friday the 30th of July until Sunday 1st of August. Tickets were due to go on sale shortly, but they are holding off until they hear back from the event's research program on what restrictions may be in place. So they believe tickets will now go on sale, hopefully in May or June, when details emerge. We expect the details to mainly consist of whether attendees can attend the entire weekend, or in fact only be allowed to attend one of the days. With these details yet to emerge and the recent news of the space allocation reduced to 2 halls instead of 3, and the Hilton Hotel now closed for refurbishment, we shall have to wait and see what this year's UKGE will now become. Our friends down at Ransacked Board Game Lounge and Escape Rooms in Worthing posted a teaser message on social media this week, saying that they will be supporting Worthing Wormhole Comic Con on the 20th of November this year. Can't think of anything better combining a comic book convention and board gaming. Think it may be a very happy place for many of us, certainly a date to put in your diary. Besides those couple of bits of event news, it only leaves me to mention the usual local clubs operating online during the week. Wednesday evenings is the comic shop in Crawley, hosting a game evening via their Discord server, with Jason overseeing proceedings. So head on over to Discord and the social media to join in the fun and for more information. Thursday evenings is Lewis Board Gaming Group and Worthing Board Gamers, so check out their social media pages for more information. And Mondays is, of course, Crawley Gaming Community's game evening via their Discord server. So that brings this week's informative ramblings to an end as we hand back to the Overlords. Anything you wanted to say to them, Brian? I'm certainly not translating that. On that note, we bid you farewell. Look after yourselves, meeples. Stay safe. Keep the dice rolling, the cards shuffling, and we'll be right here for you next week. And it's goodbye from the duck. And it's a cheerio from me. Hey, Brian, I found a couple more Easter eggs.
Thank you very much for that, Paul, and thank you, Brian. And thank you guys for listening once again. I have to find myself disagreeing with Ian again, calling Paul a prehistoric exhibit. It's semi-right. You know, Barney the dinosaur is not quite prehistoric. But anyway, guys, we are going to sign off for this week. We've been sitting here chatting for too long. Ian took so long trying to do his how to play for that game. And I don't blame him. It was a real hard one to do. And once again, I have to thank Ian very much for doing it for me while I sat back and just laughed. But anyway, guys, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to head off now. We will see you next week, next Tuesday, once again, for more tabletop gaming discussions. Until then, game safe. If you're in the UK, go out and enjoy yourself, providing you don't go around someone's house, obviously.
Stay outside, but we got this.
Stay safe, game safe, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Have a good one, all.
Bye!
Bye!
Rah!
Rah! What are you doing, Paul?